Welcome back to Making Therapy Better with Dr. Bruce Wampold. Is group therapy really as effective as individual therapy? Could it even offer advantages in some cases? Our guest today, Dr. Sherry Marmarash, is Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the George Washington University and a leading expert on the theory and practice of group psychotherapy. Sherry has written dozens of research articles on groups, along with the highly regarded book, Attachment in Group Psychotherapy. In this episode, Bruce and Sherry discuss the evidence for group psychotherapy, what it takes to be an effective group facilitator, the potential advantages of groups in some cases, and the barriers and biases that contribute to the underutilization of group therapy, at least in most outpatient settings. This is a deep and practical conversation about how we can heal together. Please like, comment, subscribe, share. We really appreciate it. And don't forget to check us out at our YouTube and Instagram channels and at makingtherapybetter.com.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. So, Sherry, it's great to talk to you today. I'm excited to talk about groups, which is your specialty. You know, maybe this shows my age, but when I did my training in therapy and psychology, groups were kind of a big deal. In fact, my master's degree at the University of Hawaii really emphasized groups over individual therapy. So I had lots of training in groups, but in current training, both in the counselor ed program or the counseling in mental health program, as well as the program in psychology, at least in my program, there's a course on groups. It's both theory and practice, but that's about it. And as well, in field placements, students don't really get much, if any, experience in groups. So let's talk about groups and why that is. But first, do groups work? What is the evidence for the efficacy of groups and in comparison to individual therapy, for instance?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. It's so wonderful to be with you. And I'm a big fan of your work, and it's great to be able to talk about group therapy. And I also have the same history as you. I'm also older and of a different generation, and also learned a lot about groups because when I was in the counseling center at Virginia Commonwealth University in grad school, group therapy was the primary mode of treatment, and you had to make a case for individual therapy. And so it's interesting because I was trained in groups, went into group work, and the research is really there emphasizing the impact of group therapy. So even despite the enormous amount of research, I think the programs do really still emphasize individual therapy, and even more so in clinical psychology. So counseling and clinical psychology also very focused on individual intervention, individual psychopathology, and individual treatment. And so I think you're right. I think the research right now, I think there's more research than there's ever been. And Gary Burlingham and Bernard Strauss and others have done an enormous amount of work compiling this research and putting it even into online formats at the American Group Psychotherapy Association and international group organizations. And there's so much study showing that individual therapy and group therapy, it's not that much difference for treatment of eating disorders, anxiety disorders, depression, substance abuse treatment. Group therapy is one of the primary treatments for substance abuse and serious health issues. And so I would say, yeah, there's a lot of research. I think there's more work that can be done, you know, and issues with some of that research. But yeah, I think that there's enough evidence to support a shift in training.
Right. So you're saying group therapy for many disorders, if not most disorders, is as effective as individual therapy. So I think the question is pretty obvious here. It's a more efficient way to deliver services. And we know, and we're going to discuss this some today, access to therapy is severely limited. Whether you have insurance or Medicare, Medicaid, access is limited. You would think that group therapy would be a solution. So, well, explain to us what's going on here. We have an efficient and effective way to deliver treatment, and we're not using it.
That's right, 100%. It's such a big issue because I can't get referrals for people. There's so many people who need treatment. Right now, we're in a healthcare crisis where more and more people are struggling with loneliness and depression and health issues. And group therapy is one possibility that would really challenge some of this crisis and the bottleneck we see in healthcare. So I think 100%. The reason I think it is continuing is many different reasons. But one of the big ones is we're a culture that's probably more individualistic. And I think we think individualistic. The treatment models have often been built on medical models. And I think that's how it's been entrenched. And so I think it's hard to shift out of that. I think that when it comes to individual therapy, the reimbursement rates for individual are set higher than they are for group therapy. And so there isn't as much incentive for a therapist who's going into private practice, who is needing to pay off their student loans, which are enormous, who's needing to start a life for themselves and create some kind of life, that they're going to gravitate to out of network. They're going to try to gravitate to get as much money they can for the time that they're providing. And the incentive is there for individual therapy more than group therapy. And therapy is challenging in a private practice. You need to have the space. It's hard to get group members. So if we don't really have that training and there isn't that incentive, it's really hard sometimes to get therapists who are stressed. And right now we see higher burnout rates for mental health care providers. So the system itself really does continue to emphasize individual therapy. And it's really sad. And you see this also in medical care, where people who have more wealth are going to be able to get the best providers, and they're going to be able to pay for boutique treatments, and they're going to be able to get the clinical trials, and they're going to get the better health care, and that the people who really don't have that access are going to be in community mental health clinics, or they're going to be trying to get other kinds of treatments, online treatments, other kind of easier treatments. They just can't get those that level of care. So I think it's an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's built into the system. We're not getting the training. So the self-efficacy of providers providing group therapy is low. But the financial incentives, especially in private practice, it seems, really are incentivize individual therapy. So as you said, if I'm in private practice, I'm not going to make as much money, and it's difficult to organize the groups and find the room for them and so forth. So part of this, it would seem, is that we've embedded psychotherapy in the medical system, which has been a great benefit to psychologists and mental health providers, because we get reimbursed Medicaid, Medicare, insurance payments, and so forth. But it really works against an efficient use of group therapy as a means.
Yeah. I think the biggest one you mentioned, too, is that training component. You know, I think if I didn't have training where the group therapy was not only supported, but modeled for me, where I actually sat in groups and saw the power of group to challenge the struggles that patients were coming in and the effectiveness of it. Like, I had to see it to believe it. And so it was like I really believed in the power of a group. And actually, it inspired me to say, I want to do this in my dissertation, and this is what I want to be doing. But it was a lived experience for me. It wasn't something I read in a book. I really changed the field. You'd have to see it to believe it. You have to really be inspired to see that groups together can really undo a lot of the damage we're seeing right now in society, whether it's isolation, racism, hate, marginalization, poverty. I mean, group creates a space for us to do some of the hardest work we need to do as a society.
Yeah. Well, that's was coming later in my questions, but let's jump right to it, because there are some advantages to group, particularly over individual therapy. And so you've mentioned a few, but let's look at it a little more in depth. What do groups bring that individual therapy doesn't bring typically?
You know, one of the things I think it brings is the reality of life and relationships. You know, it's unusual, at least it is for me, to have someone sit and just listen and empathize with me for an hour. You know, an individual therapy is important, and I think patients need that, and people need that one-on-one. But in life, what usually causes problems is not just being heard, but listening, being present, empathizing with others, understand what our triggers are, being able to process and listen to our feelings and not be the center of attention, and sometimes having to forgive, and sometimes having to tolerate difference and disappointment. And in group, we learn to do some of the hardest things that I think human beings have to do to have intimacy, which is I get to connect and empathize and I get to talk to you, but I also have to listen to you. I have to understand you as separate from me, and I have to be able to work on my bias and my struggles and tolerate your disappointments and your struggles. And in individual therapy, you don't get to do all that.
You don't get to do it, and the therapist also doesn't get to see it. So yeah. We know in individual therapy, our clients tell us various stories about how they are with others. And you know, they present that in a certain way, not necessarily to look good, but it's filtered through their lens. To see that person interact with other people in the moment gives us an insight onto that person we wouldn't ordinarily have.
100%. People don't really, I probably don't have a lot of awareness about some of the ways I come across. I think I only am aware of what I know. And I think you're right. I think a lot of times I've had individual patients that come into group and the therapist was like, I don't understand why they're having all these problems in their marriage or in school and in these relationships at work. And 20 minutes into group, you can start to see maybe why they have those issues. In individual therapy, they haven't had to express them. We don't get to see it the same way.
Yeah. And then you also talked about the loneliness issue. And let's discuss that for a minute, because we know loneliness is a risk factor for actual death as much as smoking or environmental pollutions, obesity, loneliness. And true enough, if I go to my individual therapist, I have a relationship. And that is kind of a dose of connection, but to be connected to six or seven other people, as well as therapists, would seem to be a factor in reducing loneliness.
I think that's a really important point, because I think there's something different about belonging to a group and feeling a sense of belonging and connection, that you're a part of something bigger than yourself. That is an antidote to loneliness and disconnection. And I agree with you that I think loneliness also leads to addictions. It leads to a lot of the struggles people have to, whether it's eating or food or it's drinking or working or, you know, a lot of different behaviors to fulfill that sense of loneliness. So I do think you're right. Group therapy is the ways that you create a sense of connection for people.
And, you know, it's not just the presence of the other people in the group, because often we feel lonely in groups because we don't know how to relate to others. And here we have a guide, right? We have a therapist guiding our connection. So the therapist might you know, give us some feedback about how we're alienating people by the way we express our displeasure. It's a real learning experience.
I think it's a huge learning experience. And I think your society is more complex than ever around how can we learn ways that we're effective at connecting, and then what is getting in the way. And I think, right, because if a lot of it is out of our awareness, you know, we may not realize, you know, that some of us have more privileges than others, and some of us come from different backgrounds and different cultures, and what I think I'm expressing isn't received the way I think it's going to be received. And like, why are we getting into difficulties and having ruptures? And, you know, one of the biggest things is how can we learn how to repair and hang in there and start to understand each other and make meaning out of those experiences versus attaching.
Yeah, to actually repair some rupture with another group member as well as the therapist. So, I mean, this is pretty convincing. Group therapy is important. But just sitting here and listening to this and thinking about running groups creates some anxiety for me. So even though I had training early on, that was a long time ago, being a group therapist is demanding. So I can see why therapists are hesitant to do it. So talk to me about training. I mean, somebody who wants to be an effective group leader, what kind of training is necessary to do that, or is desired, maybe? Better way to say it.
Yeah, I do think it's demanding to be a group therapist. You know, because there's less of a place to hide, and it's very challenging to be responsible for 7 or 8 people with different histories and different triggers and different experiences and different needs that come into a group. And I think people can often be triggered in group or regress in a group. And so it can be anxiety provoking for patients and the leader. And then a leader needs to be comfortable with not always being the center and what are their needs and what are not their needs, when to step in, when to step out. I think the best training, you could start in grad school by taking a group therapy course, but really to be a good leader is like anything in therapy, it takes practice. So I would say getting into a really group training program. So AGPA and there's different local institutes have training programs in group where you actually learn different theories about group and practice of group therapy and have supervision. And I really think supervision is key. And so that you would have someone watching you and observing you and you learning about it. So you learn the theory and you also have somebody really guiding you in there. I can't tell you how many times I've taught group therapy where students have told me somehow they ended up getting ready to go to grad school in a hospital setting running a group. And no idea what they were doing with people with really serious mental health issues. And they felt like, I never want to do that again. And it was a bad experience because I think what we see is in hospital settings, group is the primary treatment in the United States. That's what is the treatment. And that training doesn't match it. So I would say really good training prepares an individual to know how to plan and prepare for your group, how to screen people for group, how to deal with difficult issues, confidentiality, the ethics of group, and then it prepares you for how to establish cohesion in group therapy, which is similar to the alliance in group therapy, and how to deal with ruptures and how to deal with diversity issues when they emerge, how to consider diversity when you're establishing your group, and what are your group is going to be around microaggressions and ruptures. And then you're going to have to figure out like the issues that come up in group. You know, we've had issues where a group member suddenly wants to leave. Or, yeah, I've had situations where I was pretty surprised. We went over the group rules and a member comes in and broke confidentiality. And the tricky things that come up in real life practice that I think training and supervision prepares you for. I do. And one of the things I think is important is there's so many different approaches to group therapy. You know, it's just like individual therapy. There's 100,000 approaches now. So the training you do really does depend on the type of approach you're doing.
Let's talk about approaches for a minute, because you bring this up, because many of the trainees, particularly when they went to the VA for practicum or internship, learn their group experience is DBT leader.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a rather structured group. What does the literature say about structured groups versus unstructured groups? Is there a scientific basis to make a differentiation, or is this pretty much just like it is in individual therapy, kind of the choice of the agency or the therapist?
When it comes to, well, it's definitely the choice of the agency and the therapist, but when it comes to research, I just wrote a commentary on the special issue that came out in group dynamics. And one of the critiques I had was that, you know, and this is similar to individual therapy, where there is a bias in the research and randomized controlled trials around what kinds of studies are we doing and what's more research. So there's a lot more research on CBT group therapy than any other therapy. And there is some DBT group therapy as well, so like PTSD and trauma and social personalities issues and emotion regulation. There really isn't that much research on psychodynamic or interpersonal approaches to group therapies. And it's because they're longer-term treatments and they're done in settings where you may not do research and they may not always be done for certain diagnoses. But I will say, when they have done the research, so George Tasca's research on psychodynamic approaches to group therapy, it's just as effective. So I personally do believe that we need more research in other fields in areas of group therapy, just like in individual therapy, you know, that I think there is significant change. We just don't have the research to back it up. But when it does come to therapists, what they do 100% is what people believe and what they taught. Either they taught that and that's what they learn. And even myself, so I have learned, I mean, I'm a lot older now, but because I do videos and help with APA for their psychotherapy video series. And so I go in often and I'll learn something new and I watch the session with an expert in something I never heard of or did before. And I'm like, it was really cool. I didn't know that. And then I'll go back and I've used something because I'm like, you know what? I think we know what we know. And then we get focused on what we know and become experts at what we know. And we may not really be aware of a lot of the other things that are really effective and helpful. And I always tell my students to be kind of open-minded and be curious and learn all the different techniques you can that really help patients who may need different things.
Well, I'm curious, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but give us an example of something you learned about group by practicing it and getting feedback or just some flavor of what this is like to be a group therapist based on your experience.
There's so much. I mean, that's an interesting question. I will say, like, something simple would be when I went into group therapy and the literature tells you cohesion is wonderful and everyone wants cohesion. And so I would go in, I would say group is a whole intervention. And I'd be like, it sounds like the group wants to connect, or it sounds like the group is doing this. And I would assume, based on my reading, that everyone loves cohesion and connection, but that's not the truth. What I learned later, seeing patients, and also because I love attachment theory, is that for some people, coming in and connecting is something they're aware they're hungry for. But for some people, it's frightening. And for some people, it's the reason they're alone. There's a part of them that wants to connect, and a part of them is so afraid of being hurt, being disappointed, or losing control, or being weak, that my intervention for some was making them feel more anxious, more disconnected, and more afraid. And I think I started to realize that what works for one doesn't work for all. And as you're thinking of your interventions, it's so important to sometimes hold in mind that people have very different histories and experiences of intimacy and have different traumas. And, you know, cohesion is something that for one person may really feel comforting to and safer. For someone, that's when they're taking it.
Yeah. Interesting. This speaks to the challenge of doing group therapy, because you have to flex your leadership and your therapy to the multiple histories and personalities and motivations of that group. You know, it's interesting because there's a analogy in individual therapy. You know, we know in group therapy, if you read the group therapy chapters, measures of cohesion are correlated with outcome. Therefore, I have to work on cohesion. Same is true in the alliance literature. And that is, well, alliance is related to outcome. We know that. There's meta-analyses and hundreds of articles about this. So clinicians, and particularly students, think that I have to work on the alliance before I can do anything else, not realizing alliance is built through doing the work. And the same seems to be true in group. The cohesion is a result of our work in the group, not something that's created so that we can do the work. Would you agree with that or not?
Oh, 100%. Even if there's ruptures. I mean, you could feel stress and tense, but you would feel like we're on the same page. I am working for what I want to believe in. I feel like we're agreeing on the tasks. I feel a sense of connection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's change the subject just a little bit here, because I know you've written about this, and it's something I like to ask all of my guests, that, you know, we're in a technological age. We have video, we're doing this by video, but we have artificial intelligence. We have all kinds of various digital solutions. So we talked about the access problem. You know, every morning I listen to NPR, and a sponsor is Better Health. And it sounds so easy. I just jump on my computer, get a therapist through BetterHelp, and I have immediate access. And then I think the estimate is there's over 10,000 mental health apps available for your phone. So, I mean, maybe the need for therapy, group therapy particularly, is diminishing because people are getting help through these other pathways.
I would have to say the opposite. I think with all the technology, we're going to need even more therapy. I think we have to kind of find a way to embrace technology, because I think it's here to stay, and the changes are going to be happening whether or not some are positive and some are negative consequences. So I think it's complicated. I think there's good and bad in it. First, I would say that when it comes to teletherapy, I was resistant to do it. It was COVID that pushed me to do it. I would not have done online group and online therapy before, because I was very much focused on the relationship and eye contact. And so I was very skeptical. And now I'm convert to doing teletherapy. I do couples online, I do supervision of groups online, and I do see that it's effective. And I think it depends on who is leading it and the training, and who are the patients who may be best suited for that, and who might need in-person. So I think that it can be very effective, and especially for people who can't have access. I think what my concern with BetterHelp, and I didn't know about it until we started talking, and I said, what is it? So then I went and I looked it up, and I was like, oh, okay, it makes sense. You know, you've got this bottle that people need it. Convenient. And if you don't like your therapist, you can change your therapist. And if you want to talk to someone as much as you want, you can. I'm like, okay, whoa. I think the issue I see with that is that for me, when you're working in psychotherapy and there's a theory of change, that, you know, when you get into a relationship and you decide, I want to change, I don't like the therapy, that may be the point where you actually are doing work in therapy. The convenience of shifting therapists and being easy when you want it, as much as that's very gratifying for a patient, I think it could lead with some of the issues they have and why they may have relationship issues. And so if every time I'm upset, I leave the relationship, never going to really work out what I really need to work out. So that's my big concern with some of the BetterHelp is like deviating from making meaning out of the rupture versus just conveniently changing.
Right. It's almost too easy access that I can just, if this gets to be challenging or hard work or difficult material, I'll just get a new therapist.
And I don't have to understand why.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I don't have to understand what made something difficult. All
right. Well, that's always a dilemma, and I talk about this quite a bit because there may be some reasons you want to switch therapists. This therapist is not helping you. This isn't working. But I always give the advice that you need to have that discussion with your therapist and say, I don't feel like I'm making progress. I want to talk to you about. And if you have a really engaging conversation about that, then probably that therapy is going to work out in the long run for you. But if your therapist isn't able to have that discussion, then that's an issue and maybe a legitimate reason for switching. So we kind of passed over something I wanted to ask because you were talking about your own teletherapy and doing this. Do you actually do groups with teletherapy?
I do. I supervise two groups in our GW Center clinic. And the clinic is unlimited treatment. It's an interpersonal process group that treats people in the community who don't need insurance. It's very low fee. It's for people who, you know, don't have access to care. And we've been doing the group. This is a group that I've been supervising for 3 or 4 years. And we've had different therapists who come in and then they stay on for 2 years and then they go on to internship or externship and then a new therapist comes on. So I supervise the leaders online supervision and then they do the group online and I watch the video sessions of them.
So they, yeah. And that works to be able to do a group online.
You know, it's interesting. I would say you have to navigate some of the things. Like, for example, eye contact. If I'm in a group, I can look at you and maybe look at the nonverbals when I'm going to engage, when you're going to engage. And you don't have that online because you're just squares. And so there's a lot of work around really recognizing the limits and talking to it and having to put words to things that you didn't have to put words to. You know, like even saying, I'm really leaning in right now and I'm looking at you, John, as I say this, and I really want you to hear what I'm saying, where you wouldn't have to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are, and not surprising, techniques for making teletherapy and particularly groups in teletherapy more effective. And you just mentioned one of those. So we get this idea in our field, I think, that we know how to do therapy. So just different contexts, group, individual, teletherapy, it's all pretty much the same. And I get frustrated at different bottlenecks. But there are techniques you need to fill in. And I like your example of using the client's name and talking to them directly.
Yeah, I do think there are times, you know, we really need to be careful around screening and preparation. You know, I think, you know, not every patient could tolerate, you know, the online of the distance or, you know, if they maybe had more of a trauma history and became dysregulated. I think the presence of being in the room together can be helpful and being alone could be maybe triggering for some people who are traumatized. And I think it's really important to think through and screen what patients would be able to tolerate the distance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in some of the articles I read that you've written on groups, you've talked about outcomes based in positive psychology or in well-being, you know, humility, connection, facilitating forgiveness, finding hope. So when I read that, I thought, well, this is great. We all want to foster those ideals. But if we're going to compete in the healthcare system, reduction in symptoms is absolute metric that we all use. So talk about the trade-off of those things in group. How does it play out in groups?
I'll be honest with you. I think that I say they go hand in hand and they relate to each other. So I don't think there's a trade-off. I think if you create hope, I think you're probably eventually going to start decreasing anxiety. I also agree with you. I think you can measure all of those outcomes. I don't think that you have to sacrifice and say, I'm not going to measure changes in anxiety or symptoms report. I think the problem is that if we only measure the symptom change, we lose a lot of the reason people are so unhappy. Because most of the patients that I work with, we keep focusing on the positive aspects. But, you know, I think people who have a lot of sense of meaning and purpose in life, you can tolerate a lot of very painful things. You know, I am doing a lot of research now on cancer and patients who are struggling with incurable cancer. And, you know, what we're finding is that they're flourishing. That doesn't mean they don't have anxiety. And it doesn't mean sometimes they're not depressed. But it means that they also have life satisfaction. They feel a sense of purpose. They feel close to their family and a sense of joy. So I do think it's not accurate to say one or the other. I think they relate to one another. And I actually think if we get so caught up in symptom reduction and just reducing a symptom, we forget about the whole other part of the human nature of human beings, what meaning.
Well, again, I think we have the same tension in individual therapy. Some therapies are, in my opinion, overly focused on symptom reduction, without understanding well-being and hope and meaning in life. But I think it works the other way, too. Sometimes I see therapists, come on, this person wants to be able to go to the coffee shop and have a conversation with a stranger or even a greeting with a stranger without panicking and leaving. So we have to really work on that as well.
You know what? I think it's important to maybe listen to patients and try to really be aware of what is getting in the way for them and be open to all of it.
Yeah. What a novel idea. Listen to patients.
Listen.
Yeah. But sometimes we miss the obvious. We're so, I don't know, we get a little egotistical about this, and that I know more about what this patient needs than the patient knows. I mean, we do have expertise, and I'm a big one that the therapist has that expertise. But as you say, we need to listen to not just what the patient wants as a goal, but how they want to get there.
Yeah. I think that even if I'm an expert, and I consider myself an expert, I don't know everything about a patient. I'm getting to know a person. And as they work, they get to know themselves too.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking about groups, which I haven't thought about in a long time, and the various ways they can be useful. I mean, I see groups in health settings, as you say, cancer patients or people struggling with physical health problems. But I'm having a hard time thinking of therapeutic groups in the experience where I work most recently.
Okay, and I actually started doing group myself. So I got into a group of young professional psychology, not young, the older seasoned people who group work. And we pay a consultation fee for someone to come in and start working with us on our group dynamics, and decided I was kind of lonely in my own experience as a professor. And I think with everything going on in the world right now, it's like, you know, I think I want to be in it.
Yeah. So you walk the talk, so to speak. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So speaking of listening, what have I missed that's important for our audience to know about groups? I mean, I've talked about what interests me, but what have I missed?
I don't know. I was trying to think. I don't know what you missed. I was thinking if I had any final messages, like to convince a grad student or someone who doesn't do groups, try to get the training. I would say what I've learned from being a group therapist has made me a better mother. It has made me more insightful about the group dynamics where I work. And it's made me more aware of scapegoating and the group dynamics in the world. And think more complexly about polarization, about empathy and difference, and what we do with our feelings and how we put them and project them onto others in groups. It's made me more sensitive and have more compassion for others. And so it's changed more than just my group therapy. It's changed my outlook on life and relationships and society.
Well, I mean, you really put this in context because much of the group work was in the cybernetics movement and thinking about not people as individuals, but as groups, and that these groups become systems. Of course, that's systems theory. I mean, the example I use is emotional regulation and the evidence that we don't regulate our emotion as individuals. We do it in the context of people who we're very close to. And the research about, the power of touch of somebody who's we're intimate with, like a life partner, just the touch helps regulate our emotion. We do these things naturally in groups. Groups is more natural, in a sense, than individual therapy. So that's a really kind of a powerful message as we wrap up, that groups is the more natural thing, not individual.
And it's interesting that you say that, because when I bring up group to patients, if I really sit and talk enough with them, most people are willing to try it.
Well, this has been fascinating. You got me excited for groups again.
Can they bring you into my group?
Yeah. Well, we can do that with the distance now. So this is really helpful. I think that we need to think in our training models and our delivery models about the role of groups more than we do. And again, you know, where we have this healthcare system and various other systems that focus on individual rather than systems. But we need to expand our thinking about that. Loneliness leads to academic problems, behavior problems, in extreme cases, violence,
yeah.
And belongingness and social connection are a powerful force to improve people's lives. So this is great. Thank you very much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was so great to see you and talk about group.
And as always, today's podcast was brought to you by CarePaths EHR. Are you a clinical supervisor or do you run a training clinic? CarePaths is a comprehensive electronic health record system built with you in mind. Research shows that therapists get better outcomes and improve more over the course of their careers when they regularly measure their clients' treatment progress and experiences in therapy and then discuss those measures collaboratively. Along with a host of other features, CarePaths makes it easy for therapists to integrate measurement-based care into their practice with just a few clicks. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about our EHR system designed with training clinics in mind, and join us on the path toward making therapy better. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. We hope to see you next time.